Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Transformation expert with over 15 years of success in driving growth, delivering transformative results, and cultivating strategic partnerships. As Senior Vice President at Metropolitan Partners Group and a thought leader with the Forbes Business Council, George specializes in building innovative frameworks that align organizational objectives with customer success and employee engagement. Previously, George has held pivotal roles, including Chief Operating Officer at Sirius and Chief Customer and Innovation Officer at Ultima Telecom, driving customer-centric innovation. His track record includes spearheading global initiatives, implementing change management strategies, and creating cross-functional collaborations that deliver measurable impact. Today, we'll dive into George's insights on leveraging human-centric leadership and innovative strategies to transform businesses, empower employees, and achieve sustainable success. Welcome, George.
Hello, hello.
So I'm excited to speak with you. In our prep call, I realized and have determined that you are human. And so at the Employee Wellbeing Council, as you know, we focus on remaining human-centric. So I'd like to start this conversation by centering on you. The way we're going to do that is I'm going to ask you a couple of questions from Marcel Proust's questionnaire. Marcel Proust was an essayist, and he believed that in asking these questions, we get to understand more about your true nature. Are you ready, George?
Oh, I'm ready.
Okay, so the first question is, which talent would you most like to have?
Do I need to choose just one?
Sure. Yeah. I'm gonna make you pick. Pick a talent, George.
Okay. I would say the talent to almost instantly understand and connect with people at an even deeper level. And that is really centered around how human connectivity is just so critical and a lifelong journey.
That would be an amazing challenge. And when we think about if we could all do that, how many misunderstandings perhaps we could avoid?
Oh my God, countless.
Right, exactly. And George, if you were to die and were to come back as a person or thing, what would that be?
Oh, that's easy. A French bulldog.
Oh, okay. Very specific. We've had people say dogs before, but tell me exactly why a French bulldog.
Well, I have two French bulldogs, and they drive me absolutely crazy, but I love them to death. I'm convinced they're little humans, little aliens, and they just have so much character, you just can't get enough. So I'd say ideally a travel-sized Frenchie so I can travel the world alongside my human.
Amazing. And they really do have souls, right? You can sometimes see the souls in their eyes.
Oh, they really do.
Oh, great, George. So let's now delve into your expertise, your professional background and expertise. At Metropolitan Partners Group, you provide financing for the growing middle market. And financing is usually, from what I understand, it's usually quite conservative in its approach. So how do you encourage innovation within the partners that you finance while ensuring that you're maximizing return, which, I mean, after all, you're not a social service as agency? So in essence, I guess I'm asking is, what do you do to ensure that you don't stifle, rather inspire your partners to transform?
Wow, talk about a way to kick off a conversation.
Just lights off, George.
Yeah, tell me about it. Okay, well, what I would say first, just for the benefit of the audience, lower middle market encompasses businesses below 100 million in annual revenues. It's really a investment term. Just wanted to clarify that part.
Sure.
What I would say, though, keeping that in mind, is these companies often have tremendous growth potential, but often struggle to access the right kind of capital to fuel that innovation and ultimately growth. And at Met, we've essentially flipped the traditional financing narrative on its head. Our financing actually takes the shape of non-controlling growth capital. We ultimately seek to work directly with owner-operators and management teams to help them scale to that next stage of growth, all while maintaining majority control and preserving the majority of their hard-earned equity, which is one of the many reasons that attracted me and made me want to join MED in terms of value alignment, resonance. Also, our capital can be meaningful. We deploy anywhere from 10 to 50 million to start, and then we can upsize to 100 million plus as we scale together. So when we say, you know, helping them get to that next stage and level of growth, we mean it.
Right.
And fundamentally, though, we're looking to develop a true partnership and act as their founder first strategic capital partner. So when human beings, prospective partners, when they realize and know that you're not looking to take over, and you're not looking to really take away either their vision, take away their hard-earned equity, but rather accelerate their vision, it really fundamentally changes the relationship. If I may add, Richard, one of my brilliant colleagues and the managing directors on the investment team, once shared a powerful statement during a panel. He said, owner-operators typically limit themselves to the growth they think they can afford, not the growth they can actually achieve. Right. And this very much aligns with our uncompromised growth ethos, which is really focused on helping businesses find alternative pathways to capital efficient growth. And it really speaks to the importance of having the right strategic support and capital partner to unlock that potential.
And so you are beyond, I would imagine some of your own operators and organizations that are seeking the capital sometimes might see a potential financier as a necessary evil. And so you overcome this by being able to build these relationships where they recognize that you're looking to really support and accelerate growth, as you said, rather than take over. Is that a fair sort of characterization?
Spot on. Very well said. And really shifting from that necessary evil to strategic partner, to one who is, you know, seeking to understand the vision, really understand your story as well. I often start my conversations with prospective CEOs, not double-clicking on the financial performance
right
from the beginning, but really starting understanding their journey, what got them to where they're at today and where they want to go. Moving forward. So it's really starting there. I'm having a deep understanding and appreciation of their North Star, and really also giving them the opportunity to envision different paths to get there, and helping them get there ultimately.
Right. And so then, George, I mean, you mentioned it in your characterization as well. It really starts with relationships. And if you're, you know, when you said you're starting to talk to the CEO in your initial conversations with the CEO, it's also coming to understand them and their North Star and their story. So it really is based on building that trusting relationship. So my next question sort of centers around that as partnerships in general. From when I looked at your career path, partnerships have been very central to your career. So what is the cycle of building successful partnerships?
Oh, I could talk about strategic partnerships all day long. Like you rightfully said and so eloquently said, even better than I did, within the context of strategic partnerships, it all starts and ends with relationships, what I frame as relationship development. Mm-hmm. The data speaks for itself. Businesses report 46% higher win rates from partner source opportunities. So yes, 46%, 99% higher opportunity rate when partner influence. So even just having the influence of a partner within that discussion, discovery, assessment is huge. And 11% shorter time to close when that opportunity is partner sourced. So going back to your question around the life cycle, I would break it down into a few steps. And obviously, you know, if you want to unpack them further, please
sure.
Don't hesitate to interrupt me. So first I'd say, it's about foundation building. It starts with creating an environment of genuine connection and trust, to your earlier excellent point. Intellectual curiosity before collaboration, spending time to understand the counterparty's the North Star before you're even starting to map a joint course. Because if you don't do that, then how have you even determined yet if they would joint course the map? And if this is, you know, the right journey to collaborate on together. So that is, I would say, the first priority step. Second, explicit value alignment, defining winning together in unmistakable terms, not assumptions. I've said before, and I keep seeing it almost every day, alignment each strategy for breakfast. It's really at the core of how humans interact and build the right relationships. So having that value alignment is also key, and I would place that probably second, competing with first, but gotta build the foundation in order to get to that value alignment. Third, I would say collaborative growth meets structured execution, turning really that potential into actual results and outcomes. Also, I have to say true collaboration isn't necessarily about agreeing with everything. It's about being the best version of yourself, challenging ideas respectfully, and really working towards shared wins. For those who've worked with me or know me, they sometimes tease me about how structured I am, and that's just who I am and how I'm built. But I do find that really when you bring together collaborative growth with structured execution, that's really where magic happens at the end of the day, and where you're able to drive tangible, measurable results. Beyond that, fourth would be adaptive evolution or adaptability and continuous nurturing. So building flexibility into that partnership DNA from day one. And I would encompass and include regular engagement and meaningful interactions along the way, and also including opportunities to knowledge share, right? And drive that mutual growth, which is key. And then last but not least, or the fifth part of that cycle, would be amplification. So really leveraging that established compounded trust to expand over time. Successful partnerships are multidimensional, and they often evolve over time. You know, they really require ongoing assessment, clear communication, and adaptability.
So I'm going to bring us back to actually the first couple of points that you made as it related to the foundation building and intellectual curiosity and the value alignment. And I guess I'm sort of already presupposing what your answer might be, but where do you think folks who are building partnership, or where do people struggle? I'm going to suggest it's the first two, but again, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Where do you see partnerships go wrong?
I mean, you're exactly right. It is oftentimes with those first two, and that's why I find folks often try and skip those two into, hey, how can we work together? How can we collaborate together? Without having even established a foundation for that relationship, without having even taken the time to, again, you know, understand the other individual's values, what actually drives them, what fires them up, and ensuring, you know, afterwards that you have that value alignment, because otherwise that collaboration partnership is just not going to actually materialize or really happen.
Yeah. And I mean, in my sort of limited experience, I've also seen that the win-win, presupposing perhaps what the other person's win is without explicitly having that conversation. Would you agree, George?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think you're being very humble around your limited experience there. I would say strategic partnerships are really grounded in a framework that I've kind of coined as W to the power of three. So a win for both partners, but most importantly, a win for the end customer or company that we're both serving. So again, it's multidimensional. You need to take the time to understand those different layers. True reciprocity, going back to kind of my strategic nature and structured nature, I'd say that was supported by KPIs that both parties or all parties are aligned upon. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. Strategic partnerships are truly multidimensional. People love to this, you know, think they see the world in black and white, and or, you know, just perceive a relationship as binary. Human beings are anything but binary, and they are multidimensional. So you have to transpose that into the relationship and into the partnership.
Yeah, for sure. And I think also the structured execution probably becomes a little bit, well, I don't know, easier isn't the right term, because especially as you said, multidimensional, but is easier to design once you know what you're both, like what that win-win is.
Voila. That's why they go hand in hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fair enough. And so I'm going to come back to the notion of, or the concept of win-win as it relates to employees and leaders, because I think that goes the same in a sort of an employee relationship with an organization or leader to their team members in a moment. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, you know, we're in the age of AI, and I know you sit on the Forbes Business Council, so it would be, you know, remiss of me not to ask you a little bit about that. You're part of the Forbes Business Council as a thought leader. And so what kind of discussions have you been having as it relates to AI?
Can I be candid?
Sure.
It seems like every conversation is just centering around AI. As much as you want to exclude it from the agenda, every single stakeholder around the room, either it be, you know, face-to-face gathering or virtual room, it always ends up coming back to AI. Mm-hmm. We're in this really interesting time where we have leaders or folks either making it all about AI and or fearing the potential of AI. Mm-hmm. and starting to question the long-term impact of AI. So that's where, from my perspective, I look to center the conversation and the road mapping around AI for the benefit of really human augmentation, and really prioritizing, especially in this early-ish stage. AI has been around for different versions of AI, have been around forever, but in this phase of where we're at in the evolution, responsible implementation is probably everything. Really emphasizing people-first approaches rather than just making it all about purely AI-powered, you know, anything and everything. Again, double indexing on how AI can accelerate human achievement and connectivity, and really prioritizing those outcomes, those business cases over others to start. And the other part that I would say keeps coming back, especially as you talk to, you know, very senior leaders of organizations, state governments, it's addressing the critical concerns around AI implementation, including security, accuracy, bias, AI risk management. And the common theme that keeps coming back is really interoperability in maintaining the human in the loop. And not excluding them from that design, architecture, and or deployment.
So it sounds like, George, and this is, I mean, part of the reason you're also part of the human of the Employee Wellbeing Council, is that you are also encouraging people to move beyond fear or beyond identification of possible challenges to actually, quote unquote, doing something about it. And at the council, right, we're very much focused on remaining human-centric in, as we say, in the age of AI, as are you. So you have this passion. I know from reading an article that you wrote and then speaking with you, you really do have this passion for human connectivity. And so how do you define also part of human connectivity is in the Employee Wellbeing Council is about well-being and social health. And so in your article, you talk about social health as well. So what is that for you, and what role does it play in creating successful relationships and being successful in business?
Another great question. I would say over the years, a little bit as I was alluding to earlier, I feel that human connectivity is really at the heart of every experience, every achievement, every memory that we have oftentimes comes back to a moment in time where you deeply connected at a human level either you connect it at a human level vis-a-vis a cause, vis-a-vis a project, vis-a-vis an endeavor, an achievement, a team achievement, of course. So I would really define social health as the vitality of human connections within an organization. So the quality, depth, and breadth of the relationships that also ultimately create not only belonging, but true business value. And it's not about, or it's not just about whether people interact, but whether those interactions are actually building trust. So what we were saying earlier, are really enabling collaboration and ultimately fostering what I call social capital that then combined with human capital and financial capital actually drive innovation and growth. So it really plays a key role in business success.
So let's translate that into leadership and leadership behaviors, you know, being practical in giving also advice to some of our listeners who might be already seasoned leaders or up and coming leaders, because that human connectivity and that what you translate into social capital, if we were to talk about it from let's say a black or white perspective or almost a financial perspective, I'm not sure that leaders spend enough time investing in building their social capital. And so maybe talk a little bit about leadership. How does one effectively build social capital?
Yeah, so another interesting and difficult question.
You thought you were going to have it easy today, George.
Yeah, no, not today. Maybe tomorrow. I do want to say first that I believe, again, you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, leaders oftentimes don't invest and spend enough of their time in developing social health. And then making sure that the social capital construct is where it needs to be. A few elements or competencies come to mind. I would say, first, as a leader, we ultimately have the privilege and the mandate, though, to really act as a talent multiplier. Mm-hmm. We're really there to support and serve every one of our team members, colleagues, irrespective of their direct reports or not. And we're ultimately there to multiply their potential, their knowledge, their skill set, their trade craft. And hence, again, because humans are multidimensional, you need to do that in a very thoughtful and intentional manner in order to actually, you know, drive any meaningful change in that individual, help them achieve any milestone they're setting forward. Really being a talent multiplier is key. I'd also say a connection architect who ultimately designs environments where relationships flourish. So going back to, you know, my ethos and the importance I drive around relationship development, those leaders recognize that four walls don't define a culture, and they're really continuously looking to create meaningful touch points between diverse groups. In addition to that, you know, across leaders, individual contributors, and what I've come to appreciate even more today and or as I age is the power behind intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. So really, you know, having this true desire to continuously learn, adapt, respect others, opinions, point of views, perspectives, the most effective leaders and the ones that have, you know, the greatest impact on your career, your trajectory, I think a consistent pattern across them is that they have this growth mindset, right? They're constantly questioning status quo, they're questioning assumptions, they're challenging you, the team, to do better, but always within an environment of trust, an environment of collaboration, and that's really key.
And so I love the phrase talent multiplier, and I've been thinking when you said that, if there's a way that leaders who may not inherently or intuitively quote unquote care, right? In the sense that they say, oh, this is just about being warm and fuzzy to people and they're here to get their job done. Well, I think when you use the term sort of talent multiplier to them as well, and you sort of said, you know, how have you multiplied? How have you created greater value, talent value on your team? That's a really great incentive because not everybody, I mean, let's be frank, George, not everybody as a leader cares. I mean, there's lots of leaders out there, frankly, who should probably remain individual contributors and not actually manage and lead people. Right. But if we were to put it into the terms of like, what have you done lately to multiply the talent on your team? I love that.
Exactly. And I think being a leader is not an easy task by any means. You do need to accept and realize that you're essentially there to put others first, and you're essentially there to really support and enable the success of others and of your team members, of your collective, that ultimately will drive the success of the business, right? And to your point as well, and again, very eloquently said, a concrete way to actually impact the bottom line there is focusing on being a talent multiplier. And if you can't measure that, if you can't speak to it qualitatively and quantitatively, then unfortunately you're not delivering on your mandate.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting that in this day and age, we still, in some ways, have to have this sort of conversation about being a servant leader, because it seems so obvious to many of us. And yet, there are still leaders out there. I mean, again, I can't say percentage-wise, but certainly there are leaders and even organizational structures that support this, where there's a perspective that the team is there to serve the leader and the organization rather than, by empowering and serving my team, it's just going to be more effective.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, I would say few folks are actually born leaders. It's just, you know, built into how they're wired. It comes naturally to them. It's second nature. But we're not all born leaders, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I think the sooner you embrace the true power and devotion that goes into servant leadership, the quicker you'll be able to grow individually, the quicker you'll be able to grow as, again, a human being, as a leader, as a partner, as a collaborator, and the sooner you'll be able to actually drive, again, meaningful growth for your team and for the rest of your organization. I think anyone who you know, doesn't see that today or doesn't embrace it is quite literally a limiting reagent for themselves and for their organization. And the greats, you know, again, the data speaks for itself, the results speak for themselves, and that comes, you know, at the core from them embracing and on a daily doing their best in showing up as a servant leader.
That's it. And I think that's a super fair point, George, right? That not most of us aren't born great leaders. And so we have to recognize as well that there's lots of learning that we can always do and continue to do. I mean, to your point of having a growth mindset, if even though, you know, you've gone to a couple of courses 10 years ago, there's lots of development that has been done on, you know, human psychology or motivation. And so there's always an opportunity to come to understand and pause and reflect on one's own style, but also on the needs of others.
Very well said. It's so true. And that's where, again, over the years I come to embrace and really appreciate the journey of being a lifelong learner, mm-hmm. not thinking that I have all the answers, not needing to actually put that pressure on my shoulders. And I don't think any successful leader should. So I would also highly encourage the audience to embrace and challenge themselves in looking at the mirror and seeing if they are acting as a lifelong learner, if they're nurturing that, how they're continuing to embrace different perspectives and point of views.
So, George, as we're entering towards the end of this conversation, I guess I'm saying, I was looking at this last question that I have on my question sheet, which is really quite awkward. So I'm not going to ask it. I think what I'm going to ask is, based on our conversation, what's one piece of advice? What is one practical tip that you would give a new leader or even an existing leader of what you do in order to build a human-centric and build well-being on your teams and your, you know, whether it's direct reports or, to your point, individual contributors, sort of the broader notion of team? What's something that you really do that you're proud of?
Teams.
The first thing that comes to mind is ultimately recognizing that human-centric culture and driving results aren't competing priorities. They're mutually reinforcing. They go hand in hand, and that's key. I would say the other part that I've learned over the years that is a powerful differentiator is really practicing North Star alignment. So going back to a little bit of the notion I was sharing around, you know, how we really take the time to understand a CEO's, a management team's North Star, mm-hmm. doing the same for your colleagues, doing the same for your direct reports. When you prioritize and seek to unpack and deeply understand what the individual's or counterparty's North Star is, that's where you're able to just create such a powerful connection. That's where you're able to really focus on elements that really matter, that matter for that individual, that and also you're not only focusing on elements that matter to them, but they're oftentimes opening up and sharing areas that they feel they need to improve, any blind spots they have, and it just naturally progresses in a way that it's just so constructive. It's empowering, it's motivating. And then that what leads to just the best conversations, the best relationships, the best trajectories. You're seeing that individual flourish. You're seeing them spread their wings, and that's really what ultimately makes all of this worth it. And that's really what, you know, I oftentimes come to just cherish when I look back at, you know, different parts of my career, different roles, different mandates I've taken on. It's often the most memorable part is often just the being able to help your team members really spread their wings and just become greater versions of themselves. That is what I remember way more than, you know, the growth targets, the KPIs I met. Don't get me wrong, those are critical, but those are oftentimes a byproduct.
And so a couple of fabulous things that I take away from that, from what you just said, is one is really understanding again what that win is for your team member, your colleague. Super important what the North Star is. That's it shows respect. It's empowering, at least those great conversations. And then what you said initially, and I'm not sure if I got exact wording right, but I wrote down human-centered culture and value creation are not competing interests. I think
aren't competing priorities or competing interests.
Yeah, competing priorities. I think that's so fundamental. I feel that that should be on, you know, those posters from the 80s where it would be like a cat hanging from, I don't know, a bar or something. And it's like, hang in there. I feel like that should be at everybody's wall. Human-centric culture and value creation are not competing priorities. I think that's... that I think if we had more people understanding that or keep reminding ourselves that, it will get us further ahead. So I thank you for that brilliant phrase. So to end
up, I thank you for the opportunity to have the conversation and have it come to life.
Excellent. Yeah. So we are not quite finished yet, George, not quite finished yet, because I do want you to share another piece of wisdom. So if you could share a piece of wisdom with your younger self, what would it be?
Interesting interesting because I've as much as I've thought of this quite a few times throughout my career, a few things come to mind. I think first, you do need to embrace and enjoy the journey. I think we're tempted to sometimes overly focus on, you know, what are things that I could have rewritten, done differently. But what I realize is most important is how you learn from those, how you adapt from them. And ultimately, those lessons are what make you who you are today and how you're actually growing. So, you know, I encourage my younger self to keep making mistakes, to keep really taking risks, calculated risks. I've always been someone who takes calculated risks, though, but that's ultimately what's paid off, and essentially having conviction and taking decisive action. Our environments play such a crucial role in our growth. And in the end, I think we only regret the moves we didn't make.
Well said. I'm not much of a sports person, but I mean, I think there's also an analogy. It's something about the number I can't do it. It was either basketball or hockey about you can't win the game for the shots you didn't take or something like that.
Yes.
Right. So that was probably not a very good paraphrase since I can't remember how that idiom goes. George, on behalf of the Employee Wellbeing Council, I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and would like to thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Adam. It was just such a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Wellbeing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.